from the beautiful mountains of Western North Carolina, just outside the Blue Ridge Parkway, under the stars and around our mysterious blue planet, you are listening to
Shadows.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Shadows in the Dark this Sunday at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Time. I think we're going to have a great, great show tonight as we're going to be joined by Acharya, Acharya S., and we're going to be talking about Christ in Egypt as well as a couple of her books that she put out, The Christ Conspiracy and Sons of God. But before we get to that, we've got a few things to throw out there to let you know. And, you know, here looking at the chat room, we've got a lot of guests signed in. And just to let those who are signed in under guests know, if you sign up for a free account here at Blog Talk Radio, you can participate in the chat room, which you can ask questions and chat with the others hanging out in the chat room itself. So, you know, it's up to you. It's free and it's fun. Of course, we're not the only show here on Blog Talk Radio. There are thousands and thousands of others that are great, great programming. So, you know, good time maybe to get started. But, again, your choice. A lot of great things going on the show itself. Of course, it is October, which is the scariest time of the year. And, of course, we're going to celebrate that with our Halloween Spooktacular this Halloween, of course, which is October 31st, which it falls on a Friday. So now keep in mind we're not going to broadcast that Thursday night. So October the 30th, we will not be broadcasting because we're going to switch over to Halloween night. Now what we're doing for that is, well, you know, we always like to have a little fun here and get all the listeners involved one way or the other. So what we're doing is we're asking for your ideas on what to do for our Halloween show. It's actually the same thing that we kind of done last year. We put a poll out there and everybody voted, and we took the votes, compiled it, and whatever won, that's the show that we've done. Except for this year, we are going to do it a little different. It's not really a poll, but we have a forum now, which we put up three, 4 months ago or so, and so we thought, well, we'll use that to our advantage. So if you want to participate in this, and it's more or less kind of a contest now, I don't like calling the con. We're not really trying to compete because we really want some ideas from you. But if you go over to our forum, just go to www.shadowsinthedarkradio.com and click on forum. You'll see where we're asking for your ideas. Now, what we're doing is you just go on there, you sign up for the forum, which it's free to sign up, doesn't cost anything. We're not going to sell off your information. We're not going to spam you to death. And what you do is you just post your idea. Now, whoever's idea that we use, and of course that has to be, we have to use 100% of your idea, then you get a $15 gift certificate to our web store, which you can check it out through the same website, www.shadowsinthedarkradio.com. And, I think that's going to be kind of fun. We've already got some ideas flowing around there, some great ideas, and we need more. We're only going to do this. We'll announce what show we're going to do and who wins the $15 gift certificate on October the 19th, when we're going to be joined by Alaa Phillips, one of our regulars here on the show, our conspiracy researcher, and we're going to talk about Operation Gladio. So we're going to get a little scary on you about some conspiracies as well as announce that winner and exactly what we're going to be doing for our Halloween Spooktacular. So look forward to that because I really enjoy it. I mean, last year we had a great time doing it. We did the history of Halloween. That's what was kind of voted in. So I'm really looking forward to some ideas that can be given. So again, just go to www.shadowsinthedarkradio.com, click on forum, and let us know what your idea is. Let's see, of course, we got some new features in the forum as well. Now you can save your post as a draft if you want to post it later. You can submit some articles. We've also got a media gallery to post pictures and audio and video. So a lot of cool things going on there. So, like I said, just check it out and, ponder around the website there and see if you see anything you might like. So, well, let's get into a little bit of news here. We really don't have a whole lot of news, to be honest. I found this cool little, kind of like an article, but it was the top 10 most wanted monsters cryptozoologists want to net. So I thought this would be kind of neat just to go through these top 10, and I'm sure most can guess. I would probably say eight out of ten of these, if anything, especially those who tune into this show, because we've talked about most of them. So, well, of course, one of those is the infamous Bigfoot, otherwise known as Sasquatch. Whose list would that not be on? I'm sure most people would like to net Bigfoot and hopefully keep him alive and not kill it. But now this thing has on here a little bit of, you know, some of the description. I'm sure we know what Bigfoot looks like and most recent sightings, but to me it doesn't look like it's really up to date. And this is Torch River, Canada, 2004. Now I know we've reported some Bigfoot sightings even in Canada that happened this past couple months. So I'm not really going to invest too much with most recent sightings because, quite honestly, it just doesn't seem like it's up to date. Of course, we have the Mothman, the whole story of the Mothman coming out of Point Pleasant, West Virginia. That's a huge one that would be on anybody's list. The Chupacabra, one of the most elusive of them all, right there with the Bigfoot. Many sightings of the Chupacabra and stories around there, but nobody's ever caught one. Of course, the Loch Ness Monster. The Loch Ness Monster has really kind of fell out of the limelight here over the last few years. They said the last sighting was May 2007 when a lab technician thought he saw a jet black thing measuring more than 35 feet long gliding rather fast through the waters of the loch. Film footage was taken of the event. I don't know, I haven't seen that footage myself. Maybe something to go check out. We also have the Jersey Devil. Now, here it's saying that not a lot of sightings have been taking place of the Jersey Devil. Nothing really current. There are unconfirmed reports of it terrorizing hitchhikers, though. The Thunderbird, there's another one on the list. Now, of course, some believe this to possibly be a pterodactyl, in a way with a Loch Ness Monster, or some believe it's some leftover dinosaur somehow survived and made it through whatever the theories are to their extinction. Here was an interesting, the Loveland Frogmen. I don't think I've ever heard of this, but it's a small group of half-human, half-frog-like creatures living in the Little Miami River in Loveland, Ohio. Don't know. This is most recent sighting, none. And it says, and maybe that's a good thing. It just basically describes you as being ugly-looking frogmen with bulging eyes, gaping mouths, and bad attitudes. So that's a pretty good description. How about the Monkey Man of New Delhi? Now, it says the reports of this terrifying creature started around May of 2001 in New Delhi, India, and people report seeing a strange half-monkey, half-man creature roaming the streets, viciously attacking people. Most recent sighting was Russia, June 2001. So they even made the headline newspapers there. Spring Hill Jack. Now, of course, many of us heard of Spring Hill Jack that just bounces from rooftop to rooftop. Says first reported being seen in London, 1837. Most recent sighting, nothing really recent, it reports. How about the Dover Demon? Now, this was a new one. To me, it says the Dover Demon was seen three times during the week of April 1977, creeping about in Dover, Massachusetts, and cryptozoologists are still wondering what exactly it could be. Lauren Coleman was the first to break the case when he interviewed a teenage eyewitness who had encountered it. Most recent sign, of course, none, because it really has only been seen three times. I'm just kind of looking here, very interesting. So there you go. There is your top 10 cryptid animals that cryptozoologists would like to net and hopefully keep them alive so we could see them all. So very interesting stuff. Well, let's take a quick little break, and as soon as we come back, we're going to be talking about Christ in Egypt, the Christ Conspiracy, Sons of God, with our special guest tonight, Acharya S. So stay tuned, everybody. Don't go anywhere. Really looking forward to tonight's show. I think it's going to be a lot of fun, so back in a moment.
Want more from Shadows in the Dark? Visit our website and sign up for our free newsletter. Become a member in our forum and check out our online store. Just visit www.shadowsinthedarkradio.com, where the darkness is illuminated.
Acharya S. was classically educated at some of the finest schools, receiving an undergraduate degree in classics, Greek civilization, from Franklin and Marshall College, the 17th oldest college in the United States. Now, at F&M, listed in the highly selective category in guides to top colleges and universities, Acharya studied under Dr. Robert Barnett, Dr. Joel Farber, and Dr. Ann Steiner, among others. Acharya is also a member of one of the world's most exclusive institutes for the study of ancient Greek civilization, the American School of Classical Studies at Athens, Greece. So let's welcome Acharya to the show. How are you tonight?
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for having me on. And hello to everybody who's listening and all these people in the chat group room. You've got quite a crowd in there right now. I can't participate because I would get lost in everything and not be able to focus on trying to have a coherent discussion of this very important subject. Can't really compete with your cryptozoology creatures. That's might be a little too dramatic for what I have in mind,
I don't know. I thought that was very interesting. Somebody had put out a list of the top 10. I'm sure most could have guessed, more than half of those. But definitely, it is a pleasure having you on. And yes, definitely drew the crowd tonight. So great turnout in the chat room. I can understand not trying to hang out in there. I think we had somebody try that once in the past, and I think they talked about two lines. I was like, okay, I've got to pay attention to what's going on the show. So probably a wise decision.
I do look every once in a while, and I do see sometimes the questions are raised to me. So if people are interested in joining the chat so they can raise a question, that's great. But calling in, of course, will be great, too. Generally, we save the last hour for the call-ins. I don't recall if we discussed how you do that here on your show, but usually lay out the information I've brought to the table, and then we turn it over and people can ask me questions, which they don't necessarily
And that's a good idea, because we've already had quite a few. It seems like they're calling in and hanging up and realizing we're kind of just getting the show started. So I think it's a good idea that if anyone does want to call in, we'll hold that off until the last hour to, give us the time to get some information out there, discuss some of what we're going to talk about tonight, because sometimes it can be tough if you have a lot of call-ins. You almost, great questions, but sometimes you don't get what you really want out there. So I think it's a good idea. We'll wait till the last hour. I read briefly off your bio there, and which it continues to go on a lot more than that. So if you could at least take the first few minutes here just to kind of give us a little bit more about yourself, your accomplishments, and it just seems like you've studied just about everything.
Well, I'm getting old too, so it's kind of fun because now I've got this great treasure house of knowledge to share. I really would like to emphasize that my whole purpose in singing my song is really just to share. I'm not interested in coercing anyone into believing what I see or my perspective of reality. I have no interest in beliefs per se, in the sense that if you ask me what I believe about something that's supernatural, paranormal, like your show is about, and talking about cryptozoology, I will just tell you what the data present themselves to be, and I won't tell you what you should believe. Anthropologically speaking, I can give you the science of how people around the world have perceived things, but I'm not going to say, and you should believe that too. So that's not my gig. My gig is really, I've been, since a child, I've been a treasure hunter. And one of the things, I mean, I literally was digging in the ground as a child. Most of us do if we have the ability, if we have a nice place to dig. But because really, we had really fresh dirt, so to speak. You know, it wasn't all polluted and full of toxic metals and radioactive material and whatnot. But I came across, as a very small child, I came across a person who was digging up antique bottles. I was 2 years old, and this person was digging right on the edge of our property, and I kind of toddled out to him, and I was absolutely fascinated by him digging in the ground and finding these treasures. And these are wonderful antique bottles, sculpted things. So that was it. That was it. That was my entire passion, was to dig up treasures. And I not only have actually physically dug them up in Greece, for example. I've been on a dig there, excavation. But I've also spent most of my time in libraries and books digging up treasures. And I'm very comfortable doing that. I really enjoy that. And I dig them up in different languages as well. And that's one of the things that I discovered about myself growing up. I had a passion for Greek mythology. I had a passion for mythology in general. Yeah. But I also had an interest in religion, not so much to be a believer, but I was very interested in what other people believed around the world, and not forced into something from birth. I was born into a Christian background, but it was very mild, and it was more social than anything else. And we went to church on Christmas and Easter, of course. When I was a child, I went more regularly than that. I went pretty much every Sunday, Sunday school. I found it to be very boring. I found it to be extremely self-absorbed. It was all about this one culture, the ancient Jewish culture, and we were all supposed to be fascinated by that and nothing else. And I'm sitting here, already been enlightened as to the mythology of other cultures, and I can't see the difference particularly, and I don't see why. You know, I mean, I was 7 to 12 years old. I had all these epiphanies. I was just not that interested in this one particular culture. And the way, of course, it drones on and on. So I rejected church going. Yeah, it's a lot of droning. Even the Sunday school was not particularly interesting. It was, they're trying to instill values and morals in you, which is great. That's fine. But I was bored there, too. So I eventually eschewed all of that and moved on. I became extremely fascinated, number one, with religions. Again, another treasure, because to understand someone in another language is to really unearth, you know, the philosopher's stone, so to speak, the Rosetta Stone. It's just the key to understanding other people. I became extremely fascinated. I started studying languages very young. And then when I was 14, I went to Greece, and immediately, as soon as I got off the plane, I was on the plane, and I saw the Parthenon and the Acropolis of Athens, and I was just absolutely fascinated, absorbed, amazed, possessed by it, and then saw the temple of Zeus in Athens sticking up, this great massive ruin sticking up from in the middle of the city, and I couldn't shake it. I had to study it. I ended up, you know, going into a college and just could not get enough of Greece. Taught myself the language. I studied other languages. I studied ancient Greek language in college. Taught myself the modern language when I and eventually ended up there. Ended up there in college as well as postgraduate work. I did postgraduate work in Greece. And, of course, this gave me a really good background in not only the Greek civilization, but the Greek civilization, of course, being the basis of a lot of European civilization and just the Western civilization in general, that I also had a great feel for the Mediterranean history and going back hundreds of years to thousands of years prior to the Common Era, which some people call it the Christian Era. So we call it BCE, before the Common Era. And with the Greek education and all the languages, it really quite naturally led me into studying the origins of the Christian religion, which a lot of emanated out of that Mediterranean area. So I had a really good feel for that area. and I could read the language of the New Testament and of the Greek Old Testament. So, you know, that's my background in a nutshell and how I ended up where I am today, which is shocking people with my exposé of origins of religious concepts.
Well, yeah, you know, noticing too that in your bio says that, you know, I mean, not only you have all that, but says that you can speak, read, and or write English, Greek, French, Spanish, Italian, German, Portuguese, and even some other languages.
Hebrew and Egyptian I work in pretty regularly. German, French. I just learned Egyptian on the spot, but I really don't, you know, I learned it as I'm working with it. So it's not something you can master easily, and certainly I'm not even close to that point with Egyptian. But it's fascinating. Their script, the hieroglyphs, it's just amazing what they accomplished. I mean, all you have to do is look at the Great Pyramid, and you know you're looking at something superior. So
yeah,
that's the question. The question has always been, what if you have these massive buildings, ancient buildings, or incredible buildings like that, you know, they have some knowledge, obviously extraordinary advanced knowledge. And we find this at Stonehenge and megalithic ruins in South America, all over the planet. We find these massive ruins that show engineering capacity and mathematics and astronomical knowledge, very important part. And you think, well, what are the traditions? What are the cultural traditions that go with this? This is an advanced civilization. These are not cavemen who are bonking each other on the heads with clubs and grunting and pulling their women, you know, grabbing them by the hair. These are people who have leisure time to consider things. These are people with an advanced culture, and their language is advanced. Now, if you look at the Egyptian language, the extraordinary script they came up with, some 2,000 hieroglyphs, and it's just to even draw those more than one time, you have to have artistic skills too.
Yeah.
And so we're not talking about primitives here. We're talking about people who had highly advanced concepts and ideas running through their brains. And when you look at the religion, then you start to, and you really look at it deeply, you start to see that is a reflection of this advancement. Again, it's not just grunting, and it's not just some primitive thing. They've spent a long time, thousands of years, developing this ideology.
Mm-hmm.
And then you also discover that many of the concepts that we find in our modern religions, are not really modern, you know, Christianity is almost 2,000 years old, that you find, and Judaism older than that, obviously, you find that there's really nothing new under the sun, that these religious concepts are all rehashed. They've been there before. They've struck the human mind previously. This isn't some great new fangled thing that just came out of, you know, a jolt out of the blue, out of the cosmos. So knowing this and understanding this, being able to see this, I have been absolutely fascinated by tracing these roots as far back as I can. I find there's a belief in a bear god, possibly dating 50,000 years ago, who was considered the savior of mankind, and the, you know, clan of the cave bear thing, and that he died and was resurrected. Sound familiar? This is death and resurrection and eternal life and immortality and afterlife. All this goes back a long time. It didn't just strike the noggins of, you know, Jesus didn't bring it to the earth. It was already there. So if that was already there, what else was already there? And that, you know, that's my work in a nutshell. I try to find the origins. Where did they come from? When did they arise in people's minds to any discernible extent? And what is the real meaning behind them? Because if they're, if it's a recurring pattern, you're not talking about a one-time event in history that is applicable to only one person.
So, right.
We find the pattern is go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, and you know, I had a period in my life where, and I can't say that I studied ancient religions or religions in general, but, you know, I spent a lot of time reading some of the different religious texts. I mean, you know, the Bible, the Quran, excuse me if I pronounce them wrong, not the best on pronunciations, but the Bhagavad Gita, the Ramayana, I mean, all those kind of things. And, you know, you're right, there's a lot of similarities within them.
No, absolutely. Yeah, no, you did just fine with the pronunciations. I can't even handle some of the stuff still. I mean, it's don't ask me to speak Egyptian. Excuse me, I'm just coming off a cold, so.
Oh, that's fine.
The basic commonalities that we share, of course, in most religions, but not all of them, are, you know, some of them have basic human rights of being kind to your neighbors, mm-hmm. and very simple things like that. That, I say that those are just inherent in human experience, and they're just part of religion because of that. What else are they going to make a religion around? You know, you
right.
have to make the core nucleus of a religion has to have some good in it, or else it won't appeal to anybody at all. unless you're talking about, you know, proselytizing in the bowels of hell or something. But, you know, there has to be some selling point to some religions, their selling point is slavery, you know, being able to kill people at will. I mean, these are obviously not something I am proud to see in the human psyche, but they can incorporate the bad aspects of humankind, too. And I like to point out the bad aspects of religion so we can get rid of them. I don't want to get rid of all religion. I like religious piety to the extent that it is actually relevant to the creation as a whole, not, you know, just, oh, some guy supposedly lived 2,000 years ago, let's go goo-goo-gaga over him and ignore everything else. I have no interest in that. I see that the creation itself could be discerned as having inherent divinity. That's my choice to discern that. It's not, you know, the atheist will argue there's no divinity anywhere, I suppose, but I choose to see it because it gives my life meaning. I don't want to say, I mean, eventually you come to the point where there is no real meaning to creation in the sense that it could disappear tomorrow. It could be blown up. The whole planet could be blown up. Now, because some cosmic superhighway coming through and they just clear out the
right.
neighborhood. You know, I mean, really, it could be. And that would say, well, we really have no meaning to our lives. So we come to that point and then we instill meaning. I have chosen to instill meaning. But not to say that we are here to serve some giant male figure in the sky who has enslaved us and we must submit and, you know, bow all day long and all that crap. That's just a mental illness as far as I'm concerned. Perceiving reality in a glorious manner, I think that's a worthwhile endeavor. It gives not only meaning, but it helps to instill a sense of respect for the creation. So that's my perception of religion, and then we can also now, of course, discuss the details of a particular religion that I have focused on largely, which is Christianity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's get into that. And, of course, you know, before we know it, we're going to be opening up the phone lines, and I have a feeling we're going to get quite a few calls tonight. And I know you had contacted me and said that you had dug up some special data, which is going to be presented in your new book, Christ in Egypt. So,
let's give a little background on what I've got. I've got, first of all, my first book was called Christ in Christ Conspiracy, which is kind of well known. And now that's getting a bit of attention because some of the ideas have come out in the popular movies lately. Somewhat popular, you know, considering the subject matter they tackle, such as this movie called Zeitgeist, and then this movie Religulous had some of these concepts of comparative religion and mythology in them. Specifically, the Horus Jesus connection, and that. So I have spent the last year writing a book on the Horus Jesus connection specifically. But I had raised these connections in my book Christ Conspiracy, and then also my follow up book Sons of God. I went into it's called Krishna, Buddha, and Christ Unveiled. So mm-hmm. I have compared the three of them. And the title Sons of God is S-U-N, Sons of God. And I have traced many of the concepts of those three major religions back to what is called astrotheology. And that is a kind of a blanket term that applies not only to astro, as you might expect, to be stars, the sun, the moon, the stars, constellations, planets, but also the earth and its natural function as well, functions like the wind and the water and so forth. All of these things have been personified and deified so that they are considered to be gods, divinities, gods, goddesses, deities.
Mm-hmm.
And so you find that many of these religious concepts, if you start seeing these patterns, you think, well, where are they coming from? What is their meaning? And then you discover, well, isn't that interesting that this is the story of the sun god, and it just happens to be similar to what we find a major outline of Jesus's tale. You know, why is that? How could that be? The most obvious thing would be what we have believed for the last, almost 2,000 years or 1,700 years or so, that Jesus was born on December 25th. Well, many people today are finding out that that is really the winter solstice. And
right.
If you live in the northern hemisphere and you look out the window at, you know, a certain hour of the day, you'll start to see it getting darker as we head towards the winter solstice. Every day it gets darker a little earlier. That's what this holiday is all about. The darkest day of the year, and in fact, the end of the darkest day of the year, and the beginning of, really, essentially the new year, which is when the sun and the days start to become longer again. That's the winter solstice. That's what December 25th really means. That's the end of a three-day solstice period. The solstice starts on December 21st. At midnight, and which would be the 22nd, essentially, right? So then for 3 days, the sun is dead in the tomb for 3 days and is resurrected from this death on the 24th, midnight, 25th. So that's where that comes from. Once you know that this is the birth of the sun, S-U-N, December 25th, then you start thinking, well, what else is borrowed here? What else can we find? Excuse me. Mm-hmm. And we have a little help from the ancients too. A lot of help from the ancients. So I had outlined all this material. I had found found data from all over the place that had shown all of these parallels and comparisons and these correspondences that reveal a greater understanding of the cosmos beyond one particular culture, one guy who supposedly lived. It's actually much more magnificent in its breadth, this astrotheological underpinning of our religion. And so this material being out there, I have continually sought to back it up. And this is my whole work. People who have been following it will know that I have forums and groups and lists and MySpace and all that good stuff. Truthbeknown.com, in case you're listening, that's the main hub. And that I continually bring out this information. Again, I'm not telling you what to believe. I'm sharing what I've found. And what I've found, to me it's fascinating, but some of it is absolutely spectacular. And this is kind of what I wanted to bring up tonight, that we have these comparisons, these characteristics. Let me run down a list of them, for example. If anybody's seen Zeitgeist, they might know what was recounted about Horus in that movie. Horus is born of a virgin on December 25th. The virgin's name is Mary. He's got 12 disciples or followers. He does miracles. He actually raises a guy. It happens to be Osiris. But this person's name could also be El Lazarus. Lazarus. So we have Horus raising Lazarus from the dead, El Osiris. And then, he dies and is resurrected as well, raised from the dead. Horus does. And so I have this list of these characteristics of Horus, and they predate the Christian era, unquestionably. And so I had to really go and suss out, find all of the sources for this material. And I went, I start with a more modern, obviously it's got to be in English to start with. I can't just jump right into the hieroglyphs and find what I'm looking for. I had to find other people had translated these texts. I have gone through, over 1,000 Egyptian texts. That's what I have inspected. And I've inspected some of them in several different translations, as well as the original Egyptian, wherever I could.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, wherever it was really germane, I went tried to dig up the original Egyptian text and analyze it as well. So I have found a mass of material that backs up these correlations that we have been asserting all this time about that this basic story that you find in the Gospel, the Gospels in the New Testament, the story of Jesus, that this basic outline, also in Christian tradition, because we know that the December 25th birthday is not listed in the New Testament, but it is a tradition that goes back to a fairly early time, 3rd century, 4th century, it was formalized, but that other characteristics like the virgin birth. Now, that one's a beauty, because that one can be demonstrated in multiple ways to have predated the Christian era, the virgin birth. And in fact, I'm going to be writing a short, it could be longer than that, actually, but I'm going to probably do an e-book on the virgin birth. So this is the kind of stuff I've been digging up. I don't want to give specifics because I don't want to, you know, give away the punchline here.
Yeah,
but
most definitely.
I can tell you, I can tell you that I have found, let's start with, the virgin birth. Okay. I have found that the academics and the scholars, this is what I had sent out an email today. I said, this is what I'm going to discuss, and I'm going to also discuss why this information is not widely known. There's a whole history of keeping this information under wraps, and it dates back to before the Common Era. The virgin birth, for example, was called a mystery, and it was a mystery in that it wasn't necessarily unknown to large amounts of people, because around the Mediterranean you find these virgin goddesses who are also mothers. So people did know that. The common people did know it to some extent. But it being a mystery, it was not necessarily written down in really, you know, overt terms. Sometimes it was. The goddess is depicted as saying, for example, in Egypt, the goddess Neith at the temple, her temple in Sais, she says, I give birth to the sun, and no mortal has lifted my cloak. And that is a cloaked way of saying that she is virginal. She is a primeval creator, androgynous, who needs no male, and she engages in what is called parthenogenesis. And one of the reasons why we don't hear about that commonality in comparison religion commonality is that the academics, by academics I mean scholars who work in academia, who are professors at colleges and so forth, they talk amongst each other using terms like parthenogenesis. Parthenos in Greek is virgin. Genesis, of course, birth, genetics. And so virgin birth is what they're really talking about. But they, in their journals and their books, sometimes they never even use the phrase virgin birth. They use the word parthenogenesis. So if you start seeking out that term, you'll start finding this information, and you'll say to yourself, well, I'll be darned, they all know it. And I've had people telling me for, the decade plus that I've been online, they teach this stuff in seminary. The Jesuits know it. They know it. And I knew they knew it because I'm reading their old books. And that's in their old, their old books, they actually had this information laid out in them. This was back 100 years ago when the masses didn't really read much. Masses... up until the last 100 years or so, schooling and education was incredibly expensive. So in the old world, in Great Britain, for example, you didn't find well-educated poor people very often. There were rare people who educated themselves. But the children were not going to school. They were going to work in coal mines and so forth and so on. I mean, literally. You know, you think of Dickensian England, Charles Dickens. That was true.
Yeah.
So the masses were not necessarily well-educated. So the scholars could write in a variety of languages, and it would stay over the heads, and they would maintain the status quo. You know, the masses would not get it. And they actually will say things like, I'm writing this in Latin so that I will not offend the sensibilities of the public.
Hmm.
I mean, this is why we don't know this information. Now, I can read Latin, and I can read Greek, and I can go back to these texts 100, 200 years ago. There's some of the great volumes in French. There are some in German. I have translated from the German, had some help with that. German is hard. A very difficult book I was working with is handwritten German, you know, from like 100 years ago with hieroglyphs, hand-drawn hieroglyphs. And so this book happened to contain original information from the original, you know, the hieroglyphs from Egypt in about the winter solstice. But if you look in modern books, you will be hard-pressed to find anything about the Egyptian winter solstice. And yet this particular text by Heinrich Brooks Bay, who was a 30 years worked for the Egyptian government cataloging the hieroglyphs, that he has extensive writing on the Egyptian winter solstice, but you can't find it in English. So here I'm bringing it to light, and it's absolutely fascinating. They have a very complex relationship with the winter solstice, as we might expect. But because Egypt is not really very far north, they don't have quite the same desperate situation with the winter solstice, with winter as like, say, the Scandinavians. So it's not quite as a festive a time. The Scandinavians, obviously, with the winter solstice, by the time, you know, the sun starts to come back again, they've had a very hard winter already. And this is where you get these great rejoicings of at Christmas time, Yule, you know, with all the festivals and the presents. But you also find this celebration in places that are not that affected by, you know, closer to the equator. They're not that affected by winter, not quite as affected. And you find that it is indeed in Egypt as well. So I'm digging up this information in other languages. I'm finding that in the German and French as well, there's quite a bit of literature on parthenogenesis and about Isis, Horus's mother, being a virgin.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you don't, you also, there's certain Egyptian terms that you wouldn't necessarily know, that the Egyptologists will use amongst each other. They'll talk about, well, it'll even use Greek. They'll use the word Parthenos. There's this whole category of goddesses who were Parthenos. That means they were virgin. But if you're not looking for that, if you're looking for, you know, a frank discussion of the virgin birth in its relationship to Christianity, you will have to look outside of the really approved and sanitized scholarly dissertations. You'll have to look at renegade scholars like me and some of the sources I use, because they are really, really reluctant. I can't tell you how many instances I've come across with modern scholars who will drop hints as if they're talking to people like me who are saying, look, we can't risk our occupation, but you can, right? You know, so seriously, you can see that they're very afraid to bring this to the table. I have a couple of books where they dance around the ideas that are so close to Christianity, and you're thinking, why don't you say it? Why don't you bring this up? This divine birth, it's so much like Christianity, but throughout the entire work, there's no word about it. The last sentence says, in the book, says, and for correspondences to Christianity, more research is needed. And so then you start thinking, why would you end your book like that? I mean, your closing statement is usually something is on your mind throughout the whole book.
Right, yeah. Yeah.
But they just wouldn't go there. They just would not go there. So I'm going there. That's what I'm doing.
Yeah.
I'm going there.
And good. You know, I kind of just listen to some of what you're saying here. It kind of gets me to thinking, what exactly, I mean, I was raised Christian myself. What, you know, somebody who is Christian out there maybe listening or hears this on the archive, you know, how do you kind of present this to them in a way from to understand what you're, you know, the message or what you're trying to get across or how to say, you know, how to look into it without really just shattering their religious beliefs?
I'm just looking at Galileo. Thank you, guys. That's very kind of you. So I hope I don't meet the same fate.
Yeah.
confidence. Well, I have approached this in many different ways with Christians because, as I say, I was Christian. I was raised my family, you know, very mild, and it wasn't in my face, or you know, didn't obviously condemn me to hell and all that stuff. But,
right. But
you know, I have this other book called "Who Was Jesus: Fingerprints of the Christ." And it was called the Kinder, Gentler Acharya production by one of my most infamous detractors, who says that, you know, at least she's nicer to the Christians in this book. So that book is actually quite a good introduction to someone who's very, very much involved in Christianity, because it deals basically with the Christian texts themselves and words of Christian apologists to show that not everything is so rock solid with this religion, and whether or not it comes from God, and is it a history book that we're looking at with the Bible? Is it a book of myths? This book, Who Is Jesus, I like to say it's the CSI style. I really just went in there with a microscope and looked at, I'll look at the original words that were used in the Greek, for example. Just really drill down into the texts themselves and compare them to each other, and there's all kinds of problems with the harmonization of the Gospels. So I go into the various problems. Basically, I'm exposing again what the scholars within the fields know already. And they sit and go back and forth exchanging these ideas, this apologetics, this whole study of answers to these problems. There's so many problems with the New Testament, with the Gospels, with the Gospel story, with the purported historicity of Jesus and the whole nine yards. There's so many problems that they've had to come up with this entire field of study called apologetics, and it's got subfields like the harmonization of the Gospels, and the people don't realize that. This is why we have schools for Christian theologians. These entire schools you have to go to learn all these details, and you find out, like Bart Ehrman did, and he became not a Christian after studying so intently, you know, that there's all kinds of errors and mistakes in manuscripts, and some, you know, 150,000 to 300,000 divergences between manuscripts, and they include mistakes in the text, they include anachronisms. And I think that's very important. If you're going to believe in something, you need to look into its foundation. Is it solid? Well, I don't think it's right, a good thing to just believe in something without investigating its foundation. Would you buy a house that was built on sand? You know, that's the Christian saying, or a biblical one, isn't it? It's Christian. It's actually in the New Testament. So, you know, you want to look at the foundation. Is it full of termites and rot and so forth, and indeed you discover, yeah, there's a lot of problems here. It's not just the simple thing, the Genesis, that there was a guy here, he was supernatural, people wrote down his story, and yada, 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 the rest is history. There's what you discover is very contrived, very man-made, very deliberate. What's the purpose of it? The purpose, obviously, there's an agenda. Then you start to think, well, what's the agenda? Now, that kind of information I go into in the Christ Conspiracy, sort of like, you know, I didn't go into too much of the whodunit exactly, because I would need more help on that. You know, the Vatican would need to open up its its archive to me.
Yeah. Wouldn't that be a nice little, some great information to see there?
I think I would love to have, I think I call it a chit. You get a pass to go in, but I need a team with me. You know,
I'm
doing this practically by myself. I get a little help now and again from friends, but You know, I haven't had anybody. I actually do have somebody with a smoking gun, but I have to. I have to examine his work. He's got Buddhist texts that he claims are pre-Christians, a Sanskrit scholar. The Buddhist texts, he says, you can see that they have been taken almost verbatim into the New Testament. So there's a bit of a smoking gun that I've been curious about for some time. But I can also tell you the influences on the New Testament are many. The Mediterranean at the time was not just this little isolated backwater area. You know, you had the Roman Empire, which followed Alexander the Great, spreading the Greek culture all over the place. And, you know, it was very populated. It had a trade route. You know, this is all regular, just like we live today. We had, it was a massive civilization going on there. They had a university in Alexandria and a library there. It was renowned throughout the known world. You had trade going from the British Isles to India, at least, possibly even into China. There was a Silk Road opened up into China 3,000 years ago. You find what look like, you know, your typical Irish people with tartans buried on the west border of China at 3,000 years ago, mummified. Fascinating. There's this great exchange going on, and it had been going on. You have Indian influence going on there. You have Indians actually living in Egypt and in Rome at the time when Christianity was created. You have texts that are being brought from all over the known world. Everywhere there's trade, people are trying to collect books. And ship that went into the ports of Alexandria, the books were seized. They were copied, the copies were returned, and the originals were put in the library. So there were some 500,000, possibly more, scrolls in the Library of Alexandria by the time Christianity was created. And it's my contention that pretty much everything in the New Testament, everything significant, you could find in those writings. And indeed, that's what happened.
So, well, I tell you what, this hour is just flying right by. We've got about 7 minutes before we're going to take a break, and this is just fascinating stuff. I'm really enjoying this. And I do want to squeeze in some questions here before we go to the break. I've already noted down quite a few here, and I'll try to remember who exactly asked the question in the chat. I apologize to any of those who are in the chat room, and I don't have your name down beside it, but do keep in mind we'll get some of these some of the questions in after the break as well. The first one I want to ask here kind of definitely goes along with what we're saying or what we're talking about here. And did you come across any kind of censorship while writing Christ in Egypt? Any kind of problems come up?
Are they trying to censor me? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Yeah, I guess I said, you know, any kind of censorship that you come across while writing Christ in Egypt was a question from the chat.
Oh, you mean other censorship? Oh, of course. Yeah, that's a good one. Oh, absolutely. You know, all this stuff has been censored along the way. Anywhere it threatened, think about the Inquisition. That was a big censorship, huh? You know, they burned thousands of books. The Library of Alexandria, of course, was burned down, but then the destruction of the pagan world is so deliberate and so diabolical that when I read about it, I become angry. So, I mean, every time I'll sit there and I'll go back and I'm just writing a paragraph. I was doing a presentation not long ago, and I just wrote a very quick summary of the destruction of the pagan world. Pagan temples were looted, the priests were murdered, the pagan temples were destroyed, they were burned, there was a lime factory set up so that they could actually destroy the rock itself. It's absolutely infuriating, the culture that was destroyed, the massive amount. It was massive, and we forget about that. So really what I'm trying to do is put those, you know, absolutely shattered pieces back together again. And, you know, even such vulgar things as the temples were defecated on before, then they built the Christian churches on top of that. Isn't that cute? But, you know, it just infuriates me, especially since I really loved Greece. And I think back and I say, look what they did to the Greek buildings, these magnificent structures. You know, and they really had a sense of the Greeks did some human sacrifice. There was some not so good stuff in their religion. There was some slavery, of course, and whatnot. I'm not saying it was utopia, But their religion, and they did have capital punishment if you blasphemed the gods. And, you know, it would be hard to blaspheme the gods because there were so many of them that you could basically pick and choose. But and you don't hear about too many people being killed because of blasphemy in Greece. And in fact, you get a sense that the gods were more whimsical to them. They weren't just terrified, running around in fear and restricting themselves because a god was going to get them. It seemed to be a much more open society and less fearful. It certainly didn't produce anything like the Inquisition. So, mm-hmm. You know, so you have this much happier and lighter and earth-based and nature-based religion that is in tune with reality to a larger extent. And then this thing comes along, it's like, crunch, just wipes out all these different cultures, replaces it with one culture, you know, it's like a smear over the top, smear, literally. But, and so when I talk about that, yeah, that's censorship, all right. Yeah. And then we also find deliberate mutilation of text. Of course, not only are they buried in Latin or something, but I have found there's a text by the ancient church father called Epiphanius, who had been discussing the Egyptians bringing forth the virgin-born Savior on December 25th, at the winter solstice, mm-hmm. rather. He didn't put a date on it. But he still called it the winter solstice. So you hear, well, wow, the Egyptians, this is an ancient Christian writer talking about the Egyptians bringing forth the virgin-born Savior, and it's not Jesus. It's the Egyptian god. And so how come we don't hear that? You know? Well, in fact, one of the Greek editions of Epiphanius' writing, the Menia, it was removed. It was just taken out. Just get rid of it. When we print this up again, it's not going to be in there. So when they got to the point where they were printing stuff, you know, I mean, all along, in handwriting all these manuscripts, things were changed and removed along the way. You know, whoever was writing them, the scribes, they were not the great brains behind it. So maybe somebody was a priest or a pope or whatever, were looking over their shoulders saying, yeah, just cut that part out. We don't need that. That's a threat to Christianity. Just remove it. Oh, yeah, I found lots of instances like that. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm trying to piece together now. So this is the handicap that I work under.
Right.
Now, well, I also, you know, me myself, and I am censored too, because I have people just attacking me mercilessly. So I know about censorship too. They've been trying to shut me up since I first went online in 1995. And coming back with, you know, just if the facts can't refute me, then we have to go after me personally. And so I have, you know, that's another way.
Right.
And that's happened to many scholars in the past. Scholars have lost their occupations. This was, you know, even after the Inquisition was pretty much ended. During the 19th century, you know, Napoleon really was responsible. I haven't studied the history in detail, but I intend to, because Napoleon's history is absolutely fascinating. Supposedly, he went around Europe and, you know, kicked out the inquisitors and opened up these dungeons of horror that they had been engaging and exposed these for all the world to see, and that was really the end of that whole religious enslavement. And then we have this whole blossoming of secularism that starts around in that era, 19th century. And Napoleon was tutored by at least two people who were mythicists. These two people claimed that Jesus Christ was a myth. So Napoleon, they also thought that you might find the answers to this myth in Egypt. So Napoleon ends up in Egypt, and he opens up the whole Egyptian world to us. And now we find out, well, you know, where are the primary sources for the material that I'm exposing? Here they are. They're in Egypt. I have found them. I have put them in this book. This book, Christ in Egypt, is around 600 pages. It's going to be almost as big as... Yeah, it's going to be almost as big as Sons of God. It might be the same size as Sons of God.
Yeah. Well, I tell you, Yeah, I think. Well, let's go ahead. Good point to take a break because. And when we come back, we, like I said, I've already noted, about 6-7 other questions that we can start right into, and we're going to open up the lines as well. So anyone out there listening, we're going to take about a six or so minute break. Go ahead and jot the number down, 718-508-9887. We'll open up the lines when we come back. So Achar, are you up for a little bit of a break?
Absolutely.
All right. Well, so everybody out there tuning in, it's about time to go grab you a cup of coffee, some tea, whatever it is. Just a little break for us to just step away for a minute and kind of refresh. So we'll be back in just a minute. So don't go anywhere. And we're going to continue this very, very fascinating subject. This is just great stuff. I'm really enjoying this. So we're going to be back in a minute with Acharya. So don't go anywhere.
Visit www.shadowsinthedarkradio.com today to sign up for our free newsletter, join as a member of our forum, or browse our online store where you can find books, CDs, and DVDs, like a signed copy of The President's Vampire by Robert Damon Schneck, or the complete works of Dr. Gary Frick for only $20. That's four books signed by Dr. Frick that carry a great message. You also find downloadable products like Mysteries Magazine and the Donald Kehoe interviews, DVDs featuring Charlie Carlson and Mr. Lobo. So go to www.shadowsinthedarkradio.com today and be a part of the show.
All right, everyone, we are back, and you are tuned in to Shadows in the Dark, broadcasting live right here on Blog Talk Radio, which is also syndicated on ParaX at para-x.com, the Black Vault Radio Network at blackvaultradio.com, and soon to be part of Planet Paranormal at planetparanormal.com. So we are kind of moving up a little bit. Well, let's welcome Acharya back to the show. How are you?
Oh, great. I certainly hope I'll be contribute to your moving up with the show. Hope you won't get censored.
I hope not.
Information.
That's right. That may be our new little intro. So.
There you go.
I tell you what, we're going to start off here because we've got tons of questions, and of course we're going to open up the phone line. So if you're out there listening, want to call in, 718-508-9887 is the call-in number. Definitely like to have you as part of the show. So it's probably going to jump around here a little bit on the question. I'll try to keep it flowing the best I can. This first question here came from pretty much about the beginning of the show, where you're talking a little bit about your experience, and you were talking about going to Greece and doing some work in there, and they wanted to know what were some of your finds in your digs in Greece.
Well, you know, we were digging a site that had already been excavated quite thoroughly, especially the most exciting stuff, really, and this was at Corinth. St. Paul supposedly addressed the Corinthians. If you know about that epistle to the Corinthians, this is where the site was that we excavated with the American School of Classical Studies at Athens, which is a very prestigious institution. And I loved my time there. And I really enjoyed the excavation. But, you know, most of the people there were PhD candidates, and at the same time, these were like student digs, so that, they gave us the Byzantine era, basically. We had to slice through the Byzantine era, which is, you know, they had some really neat stuff. Like, I remember finding, I think it was a peacock plate or something, really pretty with gold, you know, around it and whatnot. But we were just barely at the classical level when, you know, the whole thing was finished. It was over with. The classical stuff is a little more, that's really what they want to get at. They consider this other stuff to be fill. So we didn't pull up any great statues. There was some neat stuff, votive offerings, and that was a long time ago. But I didn't find any excellent thing that would end up in the museum or anything. Well, maybe that Byzantine thing ended up in the Byzantine museum. But my interests are older than that. I'd like to go back to, well, Crete is one of my favorite places, and that's about 4,000 years ago, 4,500 years ago is when the civilization started to blossom there, and that is an amazing civilization, amazing culture that just kind of lived very peacefully for some, hundreds, if not, it may have been 1,000 years that they were building these wonderful palaces on Crete. That absolutely love that place. And it's about 200 miles, well, it's in the Mediterranean, like right in between Athens and Egypt. So this island has an awesome sampling of culture from, it's kind of a bridge. And it has very Egyptian feel to it, and yet it's got this Minoan, Cretan, Mycenaean overlay going on too. So that's one of my favorite eras. And I did not excavate there, but I did go to, they had digs there. There was, I did some teaching there. So anyway, that's a wonderful place. That's my favorite era. But, we didn't have that in Corinth. That's the question.
All right. Well, next question is, what can you tell us about ancient Anglo-Saxon mythology? And now they went on to say that they have found some connections between Anglo-Saxon mythology and Middle Eastern mythology.
Ah, that's interesting. Well, specifically, you know, there's this rumor that Jesus went to England. Have you heard that one? There's this whole thing, yeah. Glastonbury, you know, Glastonbury Tor, that, that Jesus was there with, I think it's Joseph of Arimathea, and there's a ancient silver mines there that supposedly worked by the Phoenicians, and so we have possibly remnants of Phoenician mythology and religion there as well. You do find, let's say, we have King Arthur, who's the head of the Round Table with the 12, you know, 12 knights. The same theme with the guy with the 12. And there, what's that all about? Well, that's the sun god with the 12 signs of the zodiac, or the 12 months of the year, and that we find that theme. There's also the 12 caliphs in Islam. So there's a Middle Eastern connection there. But there's this god named Jesus, funny thing. You know, Jesus is called Jesus, of course, in Spanish, but or Asus or Jesus. I'm not sure exactly how they pronounced it, but in all Great right. Britain, and he's essentially a carpenter god. You know, so and there we have this carpenter aspect of the sun god. There's stories about the sun god being a carpenter. And I have to wonder about, you know, if that's, there's a carpenter cult. The Nazarenes, their head priests were carpenters. So, mm-hmm. You know, here's a story of Jesus of Nazareth, Jesus the Nazarene. He's essentially he's taking on the epithets of so many different, you know, I call them cults, and I don't mean that in a derogatory sense. There's an anthropological term. The cult of the Virgin Mary, the cult of Isis, the cult of the goddess Athena, and so forth, the cult of Osiris, and all the male gods. That's just, that also means a religion, but it's within a religion. Osiris had his separate cult within the Egyptian religion. So that's right. How I'm using that word now. I'll use it derogatorily at other times, but when I'm talking about ancient religion, I use it in the anthropological meaning. So, you know, you do have these connections between Great Britain. You have the story of Jesus supposedly going there. And in my mind, what that means is that they found this story already in Great Britain of the, you know, the virgin born or divine born son of God who dies and is resurrected for your salvation, that this story was already there. And they're trying to explain, how did the story get here? Before Jesus supposedly existed, or before Christianity was really entrenched there. Well, Jesus must have come there, you know. And you find the same right. thing going on in the Americas. We had this guy called Quetzalcoatl in Mesoamerica, in Central America. He's Kukulkan right, yeah. in the Mayan, Quetzalcoatl in the Aztec. And his story is he's hung on a cross. He's got, I think he's got disciples as well, of course, and then there's a whole priesthood and there were nunneries, and when the Europeans went to the Central America, they were flabbergasted to find the correspondences. There was the veneration of the cross. There were so many correspondences between Christianity and the Aztec and Maya religions that the conquistadores went berserkers and, of course, destroyed all but four books. You know, there's only four codices of the Maya left.
Right.
And there were thousands of them. So how come we don't know this information? That's why.
Yeah, very true. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't even Kukulcan described as being Caucasian with long white hair and a beard?
Yeah, that Kukulcan Quetzalcoatl Viracocha, to me that means not, you know, not a real person, but a sun god. The sun god is depicted, you know what Apollo looks like. He's got the brilliant, the gods of Greece were white as well. But, you know, in Central America we have a puzzle. We have statues of black people. And
right,
you know, I mean, they clearly have African features. The Olmec heads, for example.
Right. Yes. Exactly.
Yeah, and we have these bearded Semitic-looking people. Look like Phoenicians. Were the Phoenicians there with Africans? That it seems to be. Could the Phoenicians have brought their religion to have influenced? And their religion has quite. There are a variety of gods. In the Phoenician religion, they actually worshipped Hercules for one, and so you find the Herculean religion all over the Mediterranean and at Carthage. And Hercules, of course, is a divine virgin-born. It depends on the source you look at. Son of God, you know, who walked the earth and did all these miracles. He had 12 labors. The sun god has, for the sun god, the months of the signs of the zodiac. And even the hours of the day, 12 hours of day or 12 hours of night, these are considered, they could be friends, they could be disciples, they could be followers, and they could also be laborers. And that's what happened in the Greek one, that, you know, Hercules has his 12 labors, that the sun is struggling. The night hours, when the sun is passing through the night, especially in the Egyptian religion, the night hours are a struggle. You know, so he goes through... the sun god goes through the gates 12 hours, one after another, and there's a battle between the serpent of the night constantly trying to kill the sun. And then in the morning, the sun is resurrected from the death of night, and there's great rejoicing. That's the basis of our death and resurrection stories. That's that's one of them. You know, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, we've got a couple calls on the line, so let's... trying to get to this because we also have tons of more questions from the chat room as well.
All right.
I have a feeling we might run out of time, though, so we'll see what we can do.
We got a whole other 40 minutes here, right?
That's right. So let's grab our first one here. So this is a caller from 616. What's your name and where are you from?
I'm Daniel from Grand Rapids.
Oh, well, hello, Daniel.
Hey, how you doing, sir?
Oh, I'm good, thanks. Hey, you got what'd you like to say?
Do you think you might get kicked out of the Vatican the same way Bill Maher did?
I didn't see him get kicked out, but I heard he was very bodacious in some of his behavior.
Let me tell you, that movie was only shown in one theater in town. I had to drive all the way across town to see it.
Well, it couldn't have been that far, but so that's a good thing, a good effort to make. Yeah, you know, he's got that information. He's got some information in there. I didn't see it, but I heard that it looks surprisingly close to what you can find in my books. So I'm pleased to see it getting out there.
Very close, actually.
Yeah, I would say that some of that Horace material sounds like it's from my work. I kind of laid it out in this multi-point list, and it seems like that list is being glommed onto, and that's good, because I guarantee you I'm showing the precedent and the primary sources for that list of Horus attributes. So
I've seen somebody put in some chats they'd actually like to see you on Bill Maher's show on HBO.
Yeah, isn't that great? Yeah, that would be neat.
We've been trying to
figure out. They have this whole little club, you know. You have to join the club. You have to be in the clique to get, unless you get sponsored by somebody like Oprah. Then all the doors open up.
Uh-huh.
I think it would be a good idea. Yeah, I think mainstream media should this information. Come on, it's interesting. It's not just like some silly belief system that I concocted. You know,
right.
It's our roots. It's our heritage going back thousands of years. It's fabulous.
Mm. All right. Well, Daniel, thanks so much for calling in. We've got another one waiting behind you, so we're going to go get to that call and the many questions we have.
All right. Have fun.
All right. Thanks.
Thank
you. All right. Well, let's go right on to our next call here, and this is from area code 601. You're on Shadows in the Dark. What's your name and where are you from?
My name is Jack, and I'm from Meridian, Mississippi. And
howdy.
I'd like to ask Acharya, what's the oldest civilization that she's detected in her research, and how old exactly does she think the Zodiac Wheel is?
Ah, that's a good, these are good questions.
Detected.
Well, thanks, everybody,
not,
for hanging on there.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead. What was the last comment?
Just the oldest civilization that you've, like, detected, like, wait, it might be a little bit older than we think. And,
yeah, right,
and so
we have the... You know, the standard ones are the Sumerian, of course, and the Egyptian is not that much younger than the Sumerian. And then we have this lovely Harappan civilization in India. You know, China's really been, they've made such a closed society that we don't know what the heck is going on in there, but there's this amazing pyramids there. There's like a white pyramid there that's a whole other area. Then, you know, the Mesopotamian area with Sumeria, that's certainly, we find some old stuff going on in there, and there's also the Çatalhöyük in Turkey, marvelous place there. There's Jericho, we found some really old stuff. They've found some interesting continuity going on there for thousands of years in Jericho. Then in Germany now, we've got a 7,000-year-old temple to the sun. And
wow.
That is pretty old. There's stuff, I think the Jericho might go back to 9,000 years ago, and maybe the earliest strata of Çatalhöyük is 9,000 years old. So these are some of the oldest that mainstream science has conclusively demonstrated. There are rumors, of course, of older stuff in places that are now inaccessible. The Mediterranean has risen, obviously, in some, you know, certain amount of feet, such that we find caves under the water. I wish I had found these things. But human beings have found caves under the water that are painted, you know, these lovely, amazing cave paintings. So, you know, somebody did not go in there with scuba equipment. That's obviously been drowned. And, you know, the fact is that human beings tend to congregate around, of course, naturally, they tend to congregate on the coast, bodies
yeah.
of water, fresh water they have to have, obviously, too. And there's rumors that there's a whole civilization, some have called it Osirian. Osiris was said to be 10,000 years old back, 2,000 years ago. So, you
wow.
know, there's this whole Osirian culture, possibly, around the Mediterranean, under the water. That is almost obliterated. You know, then there's this stuff going on off the coast of Japan, these supposedly man-made artifacts with arches and the whole idea of Mu, then you get into that over there, then you get into Atlantis. You know, what's the reality behind these rumors? And we find in Central America, there's this tribe called the Otomi, that supposedly is very old and supposedly speaks ancient Japanese. What are they doing there? You know, so you find the oldest is yet to be found, of course, because I think it's probably nearly obliterated, obviously. They do all these ooparts, these out of the ordinary artifacts, whatever it is, ooparts, that go, they're like millions of year old booted footprints in the Mojave Desert, I believe. Like, what? Who's wearing boots millions of years ago in the Mojave Desert? You know,
really?
It's just all these strange, called forbidden archaeology artifacts that are found in. What are they doing in coal mines, pressed inside, you know, coal, hundreds of feet down? How did they get there? So there's all that stuff going on. It's very mysterious what's happened on this planet. Even the origins of mankind, very mysterious. Where do they come from? Where? How are they this variety? Yes, go on.
Do you think that mythology was necessary for civilization to flourish? Is that kind of how I'm trying to draw some lines as to the universality of all this and how it became so prevalent over the years. And do you think it was necessary to start mythology, for the rulers to start mythology in order to create cohesiveness, to have a civilization?
I think that's a really good insight, yes. That because my impression is that when when we think about primitive human beings, we talk about, let's say, 100,000 years ago, maybe even 200,000 years ago. When I was a kid and I was learning anthropology, Louis Leakey, you know, when he was a famous anthropologist, I didn't learn it directly from him. Again, I wish I had. But I was fascinated by him when I was a kid and his work. Back then, it was said that Homo sapiens was only 30,000 years old. Then as I grew up and I was an adult, all of a sudden Homo sapiens was pushed back 100 to 100,000 years. And now we find people talking about Homo sapiens' appearance maybe 200,000 years ago. But the mainstream essentially says at least 100,000 years ago. Well, during that time, you know, Homo sapiens is us. And human beings have the same cranial capacity all along that period.
Yeah.
They have geniuses among them. They certainly were not just sitting around grunting, twiddling their thumbs, doing nothing. You know, they were actually doing things that we could be doing today. They're the same brain capacity. So they must have had a developed language. With the language, of course, you know, they come hand in hand is storytelling. But if you don't have a script, the best way to recall things, you have to pass things around along orally. And excuse me. So if you want to pass along to your children, let's say, something about the movements of the sun, at a certain point, people became agricultural. And I think that they may have become agricultural earlier than is believed, but that this agricultural region might be under the water because the coastline, you know, the oceans have arisen. If you went back, you might find that's why if there's paintings in caves, somebody's, you know, doing the food, gathering the food. You have to have leisure time to be doing paintings like this. So
yeah.
I'm thinking that agriculture and this beautiful art and creation of massive buildings and so forth has to come hand in hand. Hunter-gathering civilization is not necessarily going to be able to afford the time for magnificent buildings and paintings and whatnot. So the agriculturalists, even before them, in order to like travel the desert skies, the desert, you have to know the night sky. You have to have a bearing. So people would tell stories about the night sky, about the day sky, about the local mountain. The local mountain is about to erupt. It's a giant man, and he's very angry. You know, these kinds of stories. Sure,
yeah.
They would absolutely contribute to human culture, and in fact, entire cultures like the Egyptian and the Peruvian, Inca cultures were based on these mythologies. You can see it's permeating all of their the religion, very solar oriented in Egypt and Peru, and their whole culture is based on that the sun is the center of divinity to them, and you find it just permeates everything. So yes, you know, mythology has been critical to some of the more amazing cultures that we've found on planet Earth.
Okay, well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
No, thank you.
Okay.
All right. All right, thanks for calling in. All right, we've got another caller lined up, so let's get to them. A lot of people want to call in and ask a lot of questions. Definitely seems to be sparking some interest, most definitely. So, and now this one, hopefully, they've called in on Skype, so I'm hoping we don't have any issues with it. Usually when somebody tries this, click to talk. Sometimes we have issues, so we'll see how it does. And this is Seeking Truth. You're on Shadows in the Dark. How are you today?
Can you hear me okay?
Yep, so far so good.
Can you hear? Oh, okay, cool. My question was, I just came into the show the last person, and I'm just curious. So, and I don't know what everyone believes in the room, so I'm curious. What do you guys think happens when we die? Just want to be clear, I guess, because I caught that middle, like, way through the room, and I didn't catch everything.
This is a subject that I have been going into, these subjects, these like more kind of esoteric subject. So going into those in detail on my show on Blog Talk Radio, which I've been doing on an ongoing basis, and that's why I kind of have knowledge of the workings of it. Love the chat rooms. These are great. It's so much fun. It's like having a big party. So, yeah, well, I can't, like I said, I don't tell people what to believe, but I can tell you what other people have believed and what entire cultures have believed about where we go when we die, which was the question, where do we go when we die? And I can tell you that if you look anthropologically at the world's cultures dating back thousands of years, you can find the gamut. Whatever you can conceive of, somebody else has conceived of it, and they have, you know, made something of it. They may have made an entire religion. They may have made a drama or a play or whatever. You know, just the concepts are all there. And I'm fine with that. I don't have any problem. If you want to believe in reincarnation, there's a whole stratum of study on that subject. Quite interesting. You don't have to believe in it. You can just go and read about it. It's very interesting. If you want to believe in, you know, I have some funny stories about what people believe is heaven. You know, some people, I remember a friend who was, she was really ready to die. She'd been very sick. She said, I can't wait to die and go to heaven and meet my Jesus. And I laughed and I said, well, that would be my hell. And she got very angry and said a four-letter word to me. So, you know, I mean, it really runs the gamut. The idea of an afterlife, it spans. I mean, there of course, to atheists, there is nothing. You are annihilated. There's nothing afterwards. But, you know, Christians have this belief in there's going to be St. Peter standing at the gate. That's very Catholic. The Tibetans have a particular belief system of what are called mind hells, that a soul has to progress through to become at peace, which is, you know, the attainment of nirvana and heaven and whatnot. The Egyptians have a marvelous belief system about how we progress, whether, you know, in this life as well. But their entire religion is very oriented in the afterlife. And basically these massive funerary texts, the mortuary literature, you've heard of it, the Egyptian Book of the Dead, the Book of the Dead. It was meant to create a progression for the deceased. They could not believe, of course, that their pharaohs would actually be dead. So most of this was designed for the royalty and the kings, the pharaohs. But it eventually trickled down to the populace. But what they did was the deceased would hitch his soul, so to speak. There's like multiple layers of soul and spirit in the Egyptian religion. But hitch it to the sun. The sun was the great divinity. And so the sun every day would go into the underworld and battle and, you know, essentially be dead to us who, you know, during the night. Of course, not realizing on the other side of the world it's daytime, so... It's not really the dark underworld over there. There's still illuminating. The sun is illuminating the people on the other side of the world. But the ancients didn't know this. They see the sun going down into a cave or the ocean or someplace, and they think that it's fighting for its life. So they hitch, through their literature, they hitch the deceased to this, to the sun. And then the sun goes through all these dramatic adventures and then is resurrected. And so that was the whole goal, was to get the deceased to become resurrected. And obviously when they didn't see, you know, the pharaoh rising from the dead and walking away in a perfectly restored body, they claimed that it was a spiritual resurrection, that there would be, you know, another world for that. And so I really like, they have a very, probably the most extensive development of an afterlife in the ancient world, possibly, but... There were a number of themes off of that, but certainly they had this well-developed idea of heaven and hell and a hellacious experience. There are, you know, horrible, awful, demonic souls in there ready to torture you and trap you, and they have that. It was very well-developed. So in my mind, that concept was just wholesale borrowed into Christianity, just thrown in with some Judaic thinking as well, and bingo, you got Christianity.
All right, well, we've got
that's what people believe.
All right, well, we've got another call on the line, plus I still got a handful of questions that are from the chat, so I'm hoping we're going to get in as many as we can. So let's get to this next caller here, which is caller from 206. What's your name and where are you from?
Hey, this is Kismet.
Hey, Kismet.
I live way up in Washington State, and I don't really have a question, but I kind of just I've just been watching chat, and I watch how this kind of whole thing talking about religion and beliefs really seems to divide people, which is really sad because I think religion was invented to bring people together. And my belief is, and I will never say I know because I kind of get a chuckle when everybody says everybody they know everything and you're seeing 20 different I knows in the room and they're all different. somebody one of those I knows is wrong. Probably all of those I knows are wrong. But my point is that I just believe that I live for my life today. I live doing what I believe is the golden rule that seems to fit all religions, and even fits atheists, because if you look at it that you're going to turn to dust when you die, you might as well live a good life because you will still get punished in this life, even if you're going to turn to dust when you die. So you might as well follow that golden rule of do unto others. And it fits every religion. And I just think that I personally do not feel there is a point in arguing every little point in who said what to whom to where to why, when the important part of living is living right now and doing the best you can. And the rest of it will take care of itself. And that's just, that is my opinion. And the rest of it is just, I mean, it's an interesting subject. I love to talk about it, but when it gets to the point where everybody's calling each other names and and all of that, yeah, that's when I hit the red X in the corner of the room. Because I don't
what's
not
going
time.
On right now, is it?
A little bit. But
oh, really?
They're getting a little bit like that in chat room, but it's not as bad as I've seen it.
It's not, you have like 70 people talking about religion all at once, and they're not all the same religion. That's pretty good.
It's not as bad as I've seen it. So, but then of course there's a lot of guests who can't pipe up, so it's probably not a good thing. But I just wanted to call and throw in my 2 cents worth to cut, but I don't know anything. I'm putting that right out there. I don't know anything. I do know my name and where I live, but there's not, I don't know anything.
Yeah. See, that's the thing. You know, why do we have to know all this? Why can't we just leave the game open so we can continue to play? And if more people were like you, we wouldn't have to worry about religious nut jobs coming and enslaving us and killing us, you know? There's nothing to hold so sacred that you would actually harm your neighbor.
Oh, God, I'm sorry.
You just got bitten by a religious fanatic.
No, just a big spider. Just crawled down the back of my neck. I'm sorry. Little spider phobia.
Is there a Spider-Man?
There's just a little spider phobia.
What is
going
on? Chaos.
Oh, sorry.
A spider, huh?
Yeah. I live out in the woods, and we just had a big crop of them decide to hatch, and they've been coming into my house with regular, and one of them just fell down off my ceiling and went down the back of my shirt.
Wanted to join in the party, I guess, huh?
Woo! Sorry about that, sorry.
Well, thank you for the hilarity here.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry.
Oh, that's great. Oh, that's good.
Okay, I'm getting off the phone now. Before
all right.
I don't
all right.
Get anybody
have
else.
A good night.
Thank you. Okay,
right.
Bye.
Thanks, that's it. Well, there we go. A little bit of humor.
You have to have a moment like that. You just have to.
Yes, you do. Yeah, and that's, you know, that's definitely one of the great things about having unscreened calls. You just never know what's going to happen. So, but let's get to some of the questions from the chat room. I still have like six or seven questions here in front of me, and really, unfortunately, I don't think we're going to get to them. So before I ask the next one, for those who are listening, if we don't, because I even got one from email, as a matter of fact, too. If we don't get to your question, Acharya, is there a way that they can contact you to ask you these questions?
Well, I have a radio show coming up on Thursday as well. And so if you go to my website, truthbeknown.com, you sign up with my mailing list, I let you know where I'm going to be on radio. But I also have a couple of groups, and I have a forum. And I'm known to be provoked into answering questions on the groups and the forum now and again. I can't always answer all of it. But yes, that certainly truthbeknown.com. And people make comments also on my blog, which is listed there as well. And, yeah, just come and join my mailing list, and you'll find out more.
Mm-hmm. Good, wonderful. All right, well, let me ask a question from the chat room. And we do have a caller line, so if they don't mind, because they're using Skype. So, Rice, if you can hold for 1 second, because I do not want to, you know, a lot of these questions were asked way at the beginning of the show, and I just don't want to push them to the side. So here is one from Horace. Were there any Hellenized Jews in Alexandria, Egypt?
Horace obviously knows a few things here.
Yes, many questions from Horace.
Hellenized Jews. And yeah, what he's referring to is the source of Christianity, in my estimation, the major aspect of who created Christianity is a group of people found in Alexandria, Egypt. And there were many Hellenized Jews. That means Jews who were not strictly Judean. They didn't live like you see Orthodox Jews living today. They were part of the Greek culture as well. That's what Hellenized means. It means they had been exposed to Greek civilization. And that combination, in fact, Greek and Jewish, Egyptian, those three cultures, very prominent in Alexandria. And that was the synthesis that created Christianity. That's what it took right there, those three cultures in particular. Then you add a few things in from the side. We have some Indian stuff in there, too. And, of course, Roman and Greek, other mythologies from around that the whole Mediterranean and up into the Greek, to the British Isles. So, yes, there were thousands of Jews in Alexandria, and many of them were certainly engaged in the business of religion.
All right, good. Now, well, let's get to the caller on the line, and it's Risa. I hope that's pronounced right. So, Risa, are you there with us?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, and what's your name? Or do you just want to go by Risa?
It's just Risa or Richard. But
okay.
I'm really excited about your show tonight, and Acharya, you're really educating the public in a great way, and so much of what is your philosophy has been accessed through Zeitgeist for many people, I believe, in their first show. But what I wanted to ask you is about the Christ myth and the Egyptian mystery schools and the pyramid, the Giza pyramid. Do you have any comments on that in your research?
Well, thank you, first of all. I appreciate your remarks. That's my whole intent is really, you know, as I say, it's just to share what I've found, and I really find it to be amazing information. Specifically, as relating to the Great Pyramid, I don't see all that much. I mean, I suppose a connection could be made that the Great Pyramid, I believe, this has something to do with sighting Orion, or it's in the shape of Orion, possibly. That's a debatable point that some people have been working on, but if concerned, does it encapsulate anything of that we can find within Christianity? Not too sure that the pyramid itself, like, you know, does it have a solar mythology attached to it? I think the sight lines on the shafts in the pyramid are astronomically aligned. They are certainly, but I believe they south sort. What are they? Different stars than I normally deal with in my my investigation of astrotheology and archaeoastronomy. So I can't really come up with any immediate connection between Christianity and the Great Pyramid, I'm afraid. Somebody might be able to think of something.
Yeah, what I was asking just related to much of the work that, Graham Hancock and others have denoted.
That's
that
what
the constellation of Leo.
Orion.
Well, and Orion, and that the whole matrix there with Osiris Orion is very interesting in how it corresponds with the Nile. But I was interested in your studies of the mystery schools of, you know, your basis, which is the Christ myth throughout history, at least as I've understood you to follow. And could you respond then to Aesculapius and the Aesculapian myths from Greece?
I've actually been to the major center for Asclepius in Greece, Epidavros or Epidaurus, and it's a fabulous healing center with a marvelous theater. And, you know, they had an entire, these healing centers devoted to Asclepius. Asclepius was called the Savior. He is the Greek rendition of Serapis. Serapis was a synthesized god between Osiris and Apis. And that Serapis was deliberately created to unite the Greeks and the Egyptians. And little known is also that the Jews were involved in that too. And this is what we mean by Hellenized Jews. Serapis and Asclepius have been hyphenated. It's very similar. Long, curly black hair, flowing white robes, healing, called the Savior. This is before the Christian era. Asclepius' portrait is wholesale lifted by Christianity to turn into Jesus. And we find a Asclepius temple in Jerusalem in the second century. And this temple has like a healing pool of Bethesda. I think it's the pool of Bethesda where the leper was supposedly healed in the Gospel of John, right? A very Egyptian gospel, by the way. You dissect its parts and you find there's all these stories straight out of Egyptian mythology in there. And during the second century, Asclepius and Serapis we had Serapis mostly focused in Egypt and Asclepius in other parts, but in Greece, but this was a very big savior figure, and especially during the second century, which just happens to really be when Christianity was put into motion very definitively. So I think there's a strong connection there. I think a whole study could be done on the influence of the Asclepian cultus on Christianity. Definitely.
All right. Well, Rich, I'm gonna. We've got a lot more questions. We got like 8 minutes, or about 9-10 minutes left. So.
I understand. I appreciate the answers. I wanted to ask one quick thing about the Caduceus and Kundalini and that whole process of the cross and that relationship, but we can get to that some other time too. Thank you.
Well, that is very esoteric, and I can see where you're going, but I couldn't give you too many specifics on that particular subject, or I could go into a long history of the cross, all right. Especially the Ankh.
Thank you so much.
And its relationship.
All right.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks,
Great
Richard.
Show. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. I tell you, just tons and tons of questions tonight, which is a great thing. We love that. So here we go, the next question. I think we may have time maybe to get two more in. So here's the next one, and this is coming from Dr. Gary Frick in the chat room. Does your studies of ancient religions make you more or less confident that there is a God?
Oh, hey, these are great questions. You've got a good audience going on here.
Mm-hmm.
People ask me, what do I define myself? I don't label myself as an atheist or a theist. I don't, because I find the mysticism of religion to be so interesting, and it has really imbued, as we spoke earlier, imbued a tremendous amount of culture. I mean, the people who created these wonderful myths that actually have meaning, and these incredible buildings, these massive ruins, and just they don't even have to be so large, but just intricately beautiful. All this stuff that human artifacts that just reek of inspiration. These give you a real sense that there's obviously something greater to our being, and we could call it God. We know that the cosmos is massive, and I mean, you know, it is infinite. If it's infinite, then obviously we have something much greater than just our individual selves. So I leave that whole. To me, the question is not even a riddle to me anymore, whether there's a God or not. It's just what is and what ain't, and I think that there's a good reason to perceive. If you define, it depends on how you define God.
Right.
Carl Sagan defined God in such a way that I think it's you cannot argue against his definition, which was he says, you know, if you say that God is an old man, I'm paraphrasing, an old man who tallies the heads of the sparrows, you know, some guy with a beard who's counting our sins and our for his book of life, so to speak. If you say that that God clearly doesn't exist. But if you define God as the law of gravity, you know, or just like, as I understand what he's saying, that the cosmos as a totality, then certainly that God exists. So it really depends on how you define God. The inspiration that has led to just marvelous creation, human creation, could certainly be defined as God, and therefore that God would exist. On the other hand, this idea of a giant man who's in charge of everything, we have to answer to and we can talk to, personified and all this, that God seems to be absent quite a lot of the time, especially when horrible things are happening to innocent people, like babies and children. You're like, okay, no, ain't nobody in charge of nothing around here. I can see that.
Right.
So in that sense, you know, it brings you closer, and yet it also allows you to step, anthropologically, I can step out of the fray and say, no, that God doesn't exist, and that God doesn't exist, and that God's a man-made artifact, and so forth and so on. So it's a little of both, I guess.
Okay. Well, I'm a film that we've probably got about 5 minutes left, so this might be the last question of the night. And so before I ask it, just one more time, give your website and, tell them about your form so they can maybe go there, sign up, and continue to ask questions that we still have lined up here.
Yeah, well, we have a few people who could answer them besides me, it seems like, from some of the questions you've asked. Well, is it truthbeknown.com? I have a forum there. I have. If you go to truthbeknown.com, you look up community. I have the lists of the various groups and forums. Some are busier than the others, but try. They have a little different taste. There's MySpace. You know, of course, you can go there. I've got that linked too. Maybe under community as well. And they're my blogs. People ask me questions on blogs and. You know, I can't always answer everything. Sometimes I get absolutely bombarded, but then I've been known to pop up. I get people ask me questions on my email. They ask me questions on, or just talk to me. Not everybody's asking me questions, but that was the question. So there's my answer.
There we go. And also, what is the name of the show that you host here on Blog Talk, or co-host?
Well, I'm calling it the Magical Mystery School. And that's really where I get into these more esoteric questions. But it would be AARF. It's like the ending, you know, like you have an ending on the blogradio.com.
Right.
You can find that, too. That is going to be on Thursday night. It's every 2 weeks, Thursday nights. So this Thursday.
All right. Sounds good. So
join my mailing list, and I'll let you know.
Definitely. So hopefully we'll check that. All right, here we go. The last question probably of the night. We've got about 3 minutes there. What are your views on Atlantis? And this is coming from Aztec Night in our chat room.
Now you're going to get me in trouble with all the skeptics. I have a hard time. I straddle the I'm in between. I'm that excluded middle between believers and non-believers because I don't have a hardcore, you know, belief system where I'm going to get into a battle with anybody, but if you start looking at this cultural commonality and then these amazing ruins all over the place, and some of them dating back thousands of years, and you start thinking that, there had to be, I mean, what are the Semites, the bearded Semites and the black people doing in Central America? You know, there had to be something going on. I think there may have been Phoenicians. There seem to be Phoenician artifacts found in Brazil, in the port, in Rio de Janeiro, under the water. They found, supposedly in Australia, they found Roman artifacts. There's apparently kangaroos, mummified kangaroos in Egypt. I think there's been a lot more going on this planet than has been that we know about. There's so much destruction. We've had just tremendous climate change, and we've had these glaciers and ice ages and the ice melting and flooding the oceans. And it's just seems to be a common, at least a couple of fairly well-traveled cultural commonalities going on thousands of years ago. I don't know specifically. I've actually looked at topographical maps of the ocean floor in the Pacific, and doesn't seem to be any room for a continent of Mu there, so I'm not too sure about what's going on there. And Atlantis, I've looked at, I think one of the best books on that subject of a physical Atlantis might be the book by Otto Muck, but since then there may have been other studies. Haven't really been keeping up with those kinds of studies as far as the hardcore physical artifacts go. But there's something to it. And there's a linguistical, you see, the mythological and linguistical studies of cultural commonality are kind of sorely overlooked, especially the mythology. I'd like to think that what I'm doing is putting a mythological tradition or a more developed cultural tradition to these megalithic ruins that you find. Somebody brought up Graham Hancock. These megalithic ruins that we found all over the planet, that this is the tradition that goes hand in hand with them. This astrotheological religion was what inspired them. It is what came out of their inspiration. I mean, it's all interconnected. But that is what we could call it. I've actually wanting to write a book about this lost religion that would be a sort of an Atlantean religion. You know, what was the major beliefs of people all over the planet? To this day, these beliefs can be found in more remote areas. The solar mythology and artifacts that reflect solar religion, you can find them in the outback, way out in the remotest areas of, like, Russia, for example, and Latvia. And to this day, you find this. You have the Basques, for example. The Basque, to me, is a very mysterious culture, possibly a remnant of something like Atlantis. So I don't exclude any kind of global civilization dating back thousands of years. There's definitely something been going on. South America now, they're finding all these pyramids. You know, pyramids covered by forests. We're just uncovering this stuff. So I hope we, manage not to destroy human civilization before we uncover more of it.
Yeah. Now let's hope so. Well, you know what? Unfortunately, we are just right on the brink of being out of time. So I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight. I mean, obviously many people very interested in what you have to say. So thank you so much for that. And the website again is www.truthbeknown.com. So thanks again so much. It was just a pleasure.
Well, I appreciate you having me on, and I appreciate all of your listeners and their enthusiasm and their kind words. So thank you so much for having me on.
You are most welcome, and I hope we can get you back on sometime soon.
All right.
Well, good night. So we're going to close it all out.
You're cutting in and out,
here.
So I can't really hear you.
Okay. All right. Well. Thank you so much for joining us. All right, everyone. We want to just say thank you for such a great turnout tonight. Really appreciate that. Now we are getting ready to go just a few minutes into the archive. So Just want to let everybody know, visit our website, www.shadowsinthedarkradio.com. You can check out our e-store. You can check out our forum. Of course, visit Acharya's website at www.truthbeknown.com. So a lot of great stuff there. Just a wonderful, wonderful show. And we want to thank everyone for joining us tonight. We usually run down the chat room and let everybody know thanks for coming in. But so many in there, we can't. So appreciate everybody for tuning in. Make sure to join us this Thursday at 10 p.m. Eastern time. We're going to be speaking with Roland Haas, and he is going to tell us about his secret life as a CIA assassin. So don't miss that. That is this Thursday, 10 p.m. Eastern time. Should be very interesting. So thanks, everybody, for tuning in tonight to Shadows in the Dark, where the darkness is illuminated. Good night, everyone.
Shadows.